Before I can start the sermon, I have to go back to announcements. In my haste to get to the back of the bulletin, I failed to carefully check the front of the bulletin, and it did not occur to me that our actual announcement about the special project for the winter is actually for tomorrow. So this is timely. Save the date is no longer save the date. It's be there on the date if you want to participate or participate. I don't know if there's food. Do you need a noble project for this winter? Tomorrow, October 26th, the Houston South's outreach program, Giving Hearts and Hands, will kick off our new projects with a potluck. Oh, there is food. You can participate. Discussion of goals and projects and craft time. The meeting will take place at the community room at Lake Haven Apartment Homes, 1051 Columbia Memorial Parkway in Kima. Please bring a salad, finger foods, side or dessert for our potluck, and any crochet or knitting needles you may have, along with cotton yarn. We are currently knitting, crocheting dishcloths for Meals on Wheels and investigating other projects for the need in the future. If you want to learn how to knit or crochet, there will be teachers at the meeting. All willing hands from the North and South are invited. See you there. If you have questions, please call Nelda Pierce at 409-945-6256 or email or call Stephanie Rochelle. Her email address is there, or 832-721-2206. So that's tomorrow. Sorry, I overlooked that earlier. I didn't realize we had come to that date after seeing the announcement a few times. Chris also reminded me of something I probably knew but didn't know that I knew, so it might be a reminder, it might be new information. But we were asked by Tage McIntyre, who's managing the camp out this year, that the South could bring desserts for the Friday evening meal. So if you're planning to be at the camp out for the Friday evening meal and can bring a dessert, that would be much appreciated. I don't know how this has worked in the past. Most of you know far better than I, but that was the request that we received. God is in the family business. Since today is the Blessing of Children Day, we would like to talk a little bit about family, some of the elements of child rearing, and how they interface with what God Himself is doing for us. Rather than deal today with the subject of our own attitude in terms of our relationship with God, or our humility or vanity or any number of those things that we could relate to this particular subject, I'd like to talk instead more about children and their upbringing and family and church and how we all are responsible for that process. Let's go to the book of Psalms, Psalm 127. Psalm 127. Very important principle in verse 1 of Psalm 127, unless the Eternal builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. So that would be true of a temple, that would be true of a house, that would be true of a business, and it's certainly true of a family, in which case this seems to be, because he goes on not only to talk about the city, unless the Eternal guards the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he gives his beloved sleep. In other words, your life is in God's hands. The city's in God's hands. The building is God's hands. The temple's in God's hands. And as we'll see in a second, the family is in God's hands. Verse 3, behold, children are a heritage from the Eternal. Heritage basically means just that. It means an inheritance. It means there's something you've been given from God that was passed down to you by God's grace and God's goodness, God's love. The fruit of the womb is a reward. So God says children, babies, are a part of life that comes from God and that is extremely important to Him and should be looked at by us as a reward, not as a bother as some people look at it, but rather a very important part of life. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Now some have probably misrepresented this to be all about war. It isn't all about war. It isn't all about turning your children into soldiers. But the example and the analogy is pretty clear in that day and age, in that context. They are like arrows in the hand of a warrior. In other words, they're very special, valuable equipment to have. Children, happy is the man who has his quiver full of them. Now again, time and circumstances and economies and all of those things, cultures have had something to do with what it means to have a quiver full. There was a time when a quiver full might have been 15. There was a time when it was 10, like my parents had. There was a time when it was maybe more like 4. Down to America today, more like 2 probably, because of working families and because of economics and so forth. A full quiver is not necessarily defined as, you know, more than you can wrap your hand around when you reach over your shoulder to pull an arrow out. But it does say that they're a blessing, and that's what he's saying here. They are a blessing for those who have them. They shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. And again, an analogy as much as anything else, and not a reference just to saying, I have a lot of big boys. If you want to come and take it on, let's get going here. Let's make it happen. No, that's not what this is. It's using the analogy that if you were a soldier and had a quiver full of arrows, you would be able to fight off your enemies. So in this case, if you are a parent and you have a quiver full of children, you have strength and blessings and the capacity to deal with life that others may not have. God made children. God made this a part of his creation. Man was given the power and the capacity to reproduce himself as a type of what God himself is doing. God is bringing many sons to glory. We've read that many times in the past few months. But God intended that man follow the same process of instructing his sons, his children, and sharing his love with them that God does with us as his creation. Where would we be if God just said to us, okay, go do this and keep these commandments, and we never heard from him again? Or where would we be if God told us to do that, and every time we broke one, he slapped us down, but that's all the relationship we had with him? Some of us have grown up in families like that to one degree or another, and we never had a really cohesive, loving family that instructed and loved and cared for and disciplined in a productive, constructive manner in an atmosphere of love and peace and safety and security. We've had all kinds of circumstances in our families and a whole range of things. And I think if I look back on my family objectively, I'd say I had a little bit of all of that. There were times when it was pretty bad. There were times when it was pretty good. And some of you have also experienced that. But God no doubt gave mankind the instruction he needed at the beginning to build a successful family. I don't think there's any doubt that God told Adam what he needed to know before his children were born in order to create a cohesive family and teach his children what they needed to know. He didn't just leave Adam to sort of figure it out. That wouldn't be commensurate with everything God shows us that he does and how he has guided and directed his creation and how he has given man everything that he has need of. He had to give Adam information that Adam could have used, and of course some of it could have come through the tree of life had Adam taken it. But we know that Adam failed to do whatever God told him to do in that regard. God did not allow Adam to continue to do his own thing and still have the relationship with God that he could have had. He couldn't do both. And so all of Adam's descendants, or virtually all of them, that were alive at the time, died in the flood. With the exception of Noah and his children, with 8 people that came through the flood, everybody else that had come from Adam's capacity as a father died in the flood, because man had become so wicked and evil that God was not willing to put up with him anymore. And of course, we're told that Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So after the flood, God started over a few generations after the flood, and then he called Abraham. And it was that calling of Abraham that began a whole new process. Let's go back to Genesis 18. Genesis 18. God, of course, has already talked to Abraham and selected Abraham as his friend and blessed him and given him certain promises. And here in chapter 18, we have him saying about Abraham when they were about to destroy Sodom, the the Lord was talking with the angels, and he said in verse 17, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation," that was already determined, "and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him." He's going to be an interactive personal friend and acquaintance and means of accomplishing my purpose. So should I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? No, I need to tell Abraham and share with him what's going on. Verse 19, "For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the eternal." Notice he says he may command his children and his household, but that's not the end of it. It's not just a command, it's that they keep the way of the eternal to do righteousness and justice, that the eternal may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. So God says, I know Abraham. I called Abraham, I have blessed him, and I've also given him what he needs to teach his children. Did Abraham's children go without sin? Did they do everything right in their lives? No, of course. But where did the blessing go? It went from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Joseph, to Joseph's two sons, whom Jacob blessed and set them apart and gave them his own name of Israel. And so God knew that Abraham would, in various ways, teach and influence his children that they would be able to hold on to the relationship and the covenant with God. Now, God worked with each of them individually, of course, as he does with our children. And that's the beauty of it. God works with us and tells us, here, do this with your children, teach them, instruct them, bring them along in the way of the Lord. But then God intervenes and works with them himself and provides what they have need of as long as they are willing to respond to their parents and as long as they're willing to respond to him. So God gave Abraham what it took to start a family line that would keep a covenant with God, that would be obedient to God, and that would therefore be blessed. Not only by their own obedience, of course, because Israel certainly fell far short. God promised them blessings whether they obeyed or not, but he gave them the opportunity to obey and to have further riches and abundance in their lives. But of course, Abraham's children didn't all do that. We later find in Isaiah chapter 3 an analysis of or prophecy of what is going to happen in Israel. It was already happening in Israel, but it certainly is a reference to our day today as well, because it's in the context of future and the day of the Lord and God's plan. So in Isaiah chapter 3, verse 12, we find this. "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths." So they were no longer getting proper guidance and instruction from either the parents, by that I mean the patriarchs on down. I'm not talking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when I say the patriarchs, is what that term normally means. But their parents, their grandparents, their great-grandparents, at whatever level, they were not getting instruction from family elders, nor were they getting guidance and instruction from government leaders, the princes and kings who ruled over them. So he says, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. And so it ends up with the family and society turned upside down with a change of roles that is pretty dramatic here. This doesn't mean, of course, anything about our current politics or our current way of doing things in the modern world. When I say doesn't mean anything, it means something, but it's not a specific reference to everything that we see going on around us today. It is a reference to a principle in which children are oppressive to their parents. Children become problems. Children become uncontrollable. Children bring problems on the family. And women rule over the husbands and the children. And, of course, in some cases, women rule over nations. Some of them have been relatively good rulers by contrast with some of the men who have ruled some of the nations. So God is simply saying that it's all been turned upside down, and that people don't understand what is important and what's necessary for a family to work. So how'd this happen? What goes wrong with Abraham's descendants, the later generations of Israel? Where'd they fail in receiving the blessing of God? Didn't God give them what they needed? Did God leave Israel and abandon Israel? Well, we just read that they who lead you, have caused you to err. But let's look at what they erred from. Let's look at where they went astray. I go back to Deuteronomy now, when we see Israel being given the second giving of the law, as the word Deuteronomy means, in Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 40. You could start much earlier, but let's read verse 40 for time. You shall therefore keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children. I want you to note that it says with you and with your children. In other words, the obedience and responsiveness of the parents have something to do with what's going to happen with the children. You keep the commandments and the statutes which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Eternal your God is giving you for all time. So Moses was telling him, look, it's between you and God, and if you're willing to do your part, you can have a good life, you can continue to live in the land, and you can prosper. And of course, the commandment had been given much earlier. This is the final counsel to Israel before they go into the promised land. But let's go back to Exodus chapter 20 when they were given the commandments and see what it says there. Exodus chapter 20. The second commandment here, Number 4. Verse 4, you shall not make for yourself a carved image. This is the commandment on idolatry. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Eternal your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity, that is the sins or the lawlessness, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. So there's a penalty that devolves on down for generations, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. Again, some of us have probably suffered from that very kind of circumstance where our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, whomever, were rejecting God to the point that it caused them to have difficulties and problems, and those problems trickled down to those of us in our own generation. So God says, I visit the iniquity of the fourth, third, and fourth generation. In verse 6, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So God says, I'm going to look and I'm going to make a judgment. I'm going to discern between those who keep my commandments and those who don't. And they and their children are going to either prosper or suffer accordingly. How many of these Israelites that were told this in Exodus chapter 20 at the Mount Sinai discussion, how many of them survived? How many of them went into the promised land and lived there happily ever after? Think about it. None except the little children. The children under 20 years old, he says. Later, the rest of them died in the wilderness. Only the children survived because the parents turned against God and rebelled against God. Let's go to Deuteronomy again, Deuteronomy chapter 1 this time. Deuteronomy 1, verse 35. Deuteronomy 1, 35. The story is being recounted here by Moses. Verse 34, and the Eternal heard the sound of your words and was angry and took an oath, saying, surely none... not one of these men of this evil generation shall see that good land of which I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who he shall see it, and to him and his children I am giving the land on which he walked, because he wholly followed the Eternal. A very direct example here of where God says, look, Caleb did what I told him to do. Now, when he says, except for Caleb, Joshua is excluded because Joshua is a special case and chosen to lead them into the promised land. And Joshua was also like Caleb. He brought a good report. Remember, the two of them brought an honest report. Everybody else didn't. And so he says to Caleb, To him and to his children I am giving the land on which he walked, because he wholly followed the Eternal. Do we see parents, grandparents, whomever we might be, how our following God fully and wholly, committing ourselves to God's way, is going to trickle down to our children and grandchildren, even if they don't recognize it at the moment? They are going to be blessed in some way because of our obedience. We have in the church today, of course, fourth and fifth generation Christians. In some cases, we have five generations still alive in the church. That's a beautiful thing. And in most cases, not all cases, some cases it was the third generation that was converted, and then the parents and the grandparents were converted. But in most cases, it was the older generation that were converted, and their lifestyle and their example trickled down to their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and there are all kinds of family members obeying God. We don't call them. We can't call them. We can't bring our children into the church, technically. But God has sanctified them and given us an opportunity to teach them in a way that they can become part of the church, which the average child in the world simply cannot do. So our obedience and service to God, like that of Caleb, can have an effect on our children, whether they know it now or not, whether they're even willing to accept it now or not. But God said he would bless Caleb and give the land to his children as well because of his personal obedience. But what was God's purpose and intent for Israel? What did he want for them? That's also contained a couple of pages over in Deuteronomy chapter 5, a very well-known scripture that we often quote, chapter 5, verse 29, where God talks about the attitude. God talks about the heart. God talks about the goal of life and who we are and where we're going. And in chapter 5, verse 29, he says of Israel, "Oh, that they had such a heart." In other words, "Oh, that they would have. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments." And what would the result be? "That it might be well with them and with their children forever." God says it starts with a heart to obey him. And a heart to obey him then becomes an example and a way of life that builds a hedge around children and grandchildren and allows them an opportunity to know God and allows them to have that blessing generation after generation for the long term. In this case, he calls it forever. So God wanted Israel to succeed. God had wanted Adam and Eve to succeed. God wanted mankind to succeed. God is bringing many sons to glory. Why bring them the hard way? God wanted us to teach our children and preserve them to the degree that we possibly can. Let's go to Psalm 78. Psalm 78 again reveals a bit of a formula and an attitude, if you will, that God made available to us, but mankind, including Israel, who had it made available directly to them, did not follow. Psalm 78. Let me break into the thought in verse 5. There's actually very good material in the previous few verses, but verse 5, "For he established a testimony in Jacob," that is Israel, "and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children." Notice the responsibility. "That they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare them to their children, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments." You see that formula? You see that process? God said, he set a law there. He gave them commandments. He gave them instructions that they should make them known to their children, who would in turn make them known to the children who would yet be born, who would in turn make them available to their children. This was a generational process of living a right way and then teaching a right way in conjunction with your example and your way of life. You don't live a right way and teach unrighteousness, do you? But teaching righteousness while you're living a wicked way doesn't work either. So you cannot live a righteous life and teach wickedness. You can't live a wicked life and teach righteousness. God is saying, live according to my law and my commandments and teach your children and let them see and understand that this is a way of life, a good way of life, a profitable way of life. Pass it on, we would say in our day. Here it is. Here's the truth. Here's a pearl of great price. Pass it on. And what for? That they may set their hope in God, verse 7, and not forget the works of God. Has Israel done that? No. Israel has not preserved the truth so that people set their hope in God. Instead, more and more people are saying they don't believe any such God exists here in Israel. That's becoming a much more common event. Now, I read recently, and maybe I mentioned this, you know I repeat myself because I forget everything next week, but I read recently that there are actually churches here in the Houston area that are churches of unbelief. They're churches of basically atheists. They're churches who say, we need the togetherness, we need the common purpose, we need the comfort, we need the encouragement week in and week out, but we don't want any of that God stuff. We don't want any of that Bible stuff. We just want to get together and kind of help each other out. So they've actually formed official organizations, and in a sense they call themselves churches, though they say that's a confusing word, and they come together and have their meetings without God. That isn't what God intended. That they may set their hope in God. What has man done? What has modern America done? We have fallen back on the generation gap. The generation gap. Somehow it is something we can't deal with. It overtakes us. It's a big force in motion, and we're powerless to deal with it. It's as if we created this giant imaginary enemy, but we have seen him as too big to fight. So we accept the concept of a generation gap in which parents and children just have to go at it. You know, it's just got to be back and forth, face to face, head to head. Can't have any peace, can't have any understanding, can't have any common ground. It's got to have a generation gap. So let's recognize that and then try to figure out how to sneak around it. We have a belief that we have to have conflict with our kids, that they're going to grow up the wrong way no matter what we do. And that's especially true, of course, of teenagers. You're always going to have to run into problems and challenges with teenagers. Some people do, and you can't necessarily judge them by what teenagers do. Please understand, this is a fine line. Teenagers are not always going to respond to the proper instruction and education they've been given in the home. Sometimes they're going to go their own way anyway. But if parents have simply decided in advance that they're going to go their own way, so we'll wait, as I've had people tell me, I'll wait till they're 18 and then try to talk sense into them. Now, you're way overboard by that time. Of course, there is a generation gap. Every generation, probably from creation, has had a generation gap because the parents have lived already 20 or 30 or maybe 600 years, if you go back to Genesis. They have lived a few years, and sometimes dozens or scores or hundreds of years, and the next generation can't possibly put themselves in their shoes and know and understand everything the parents think. And because the mind is fertile and capable and youth is energetic, they're going to have a little bit different way of looking at things than the parents have of looking at it. You're going to have a generation gap. The challenge is to bridge that gap. The challenge is to take what the parents know and share it with the children, and make it relevant, and make it applicable, and help them to come to understand what they need to know and do as young people at whatever age in order to enjoy the blessings that you enjoy as an obedient to God adult. We never bought into the generation gap in our family. Judy and I simply didn't accept it as a truth. We believed it was contrary to God's word. We believed it was contrary to God's instruction to parents to say that there was this unbridgeable generation gap. When I say we didn't buy into the gap, again, the gap is there in the sense of capacity and knowledge and ability and so forth. But there needs to be communication and interaction beyond across that gap that works for everybody. You don't often hear me bragging on my children, and I don't intend to do that. But I will say that I used to have friends who would say, well, I'm having this problem, this problem, this problem. You know what it's like. You've raised teenagers. And I would have to say, no, I don't know what it's like because my teenagers never acted like that. I know I was deeply blessed with that. I understand that. It wasn't all my doing by any means. But we never had the kind of conflict in our home when our kids were teenagers that we hear other people talk about. And I've seen many other families who managed to avoid that stage. They managed to live happy, compatible, enjoyable lives without a constant battle between their kids and the parents. Lots of families have succeeded in doing that. Again, it depends a lot on your genetics, depends maybe on your parents and grandparents and great-grandparents, on what is happening in the family. But we need to break that cycle wherever we can and make sure that we're doing our part to produce an environment that makes it possible for kids to live effectively. So how are parents to proceed? How do we make sense of child rearing and child training in our day and age? First, we start by remembering that God doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. So God's word and God's law and God's principles stay the same. And God's methods basically stay the same. Is God adaptable? Sure, in the sense that he can see what's going on and work with the situation. But God doesn't change. God doesn't just suddenly say, oh, I think I'll do it a different way now. No, God takes the circumstances and judges them and deals accordingly, but only within his law and within his framework of teaching and instruction. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, we know it well, but we would do well to oft repeat it. Genesis chapter 6. This whole section is remarkable in that, again, it summarizes the whole picture of life and society and family. Let's start in verse 1. Now, this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Eternal your God has commanded. This comes right after the repeating of the Ten Commandments in chapter 5. To teach you that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Eternal your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you, you and your son and your grandson. Notice here, Moses is instructing them to keep the law, but also that their grandson should be keeping it. So there was some responsibility to pass it on. There was some accountability for how you built an environment in which your children and your grandchildren could learn the truth. All the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, that has to do with the children, as the Eternal God of your fathers has promised you, a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Eternal our God is, the Lord is one. You shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart. So the attitude comes first, not the physical details of obedience, but the attitude. You shall love the Eternal your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And of course, you demonstrate that by the keeping of the commandments and the yieldedness to God's way. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. So it starts with having the right attitude and the right frame of mind in your heart. If you don't have that, you're never going to teach your children, your grandchildren, or anybody else how to serve God. You have to start with believing it, with accepting it, with fulfilling it, with embracing it, with being happy with the truth. You have to be happy with the truth, or you're not going to teach anybody God's way. If you're critical all the time, if you're frustrated, if you're unhappy, if you're begrudgingly obeying God out of fear, your children will pick up on that. They'll know that. God says, put it in your heart. And then, verse 7, you shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. And again, this is not a specific formula of do it at these four times or whatever. It is a way of life. It's saying you live your life fully in God's way and share it with your children, talking to them endlessly not just constantly badgering them about obeying God, but talking to them about the good things of God, the why you keep God's law, the blessings you have received, the things you expect from God. He's talking not about cramming it into your kids day in and day out, one day after the next. He's talking about a way of life. Talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. I can say as a compliment to my wife that our children knew the truth pretty well by the time they were five. Knew the truth pretty well because she talked to them continuously about God and God's way no matter what she was doing. Washing dishes, washing clothes, nursing the baby, yes, talking to them at that age. And continually filled their minds with the truth of God, not in a badgering learn this or else way at all, but in a sharing of why she lived the way she lived, why we lived the way we lived. I participated in that somewhat in the times that I had with them, which were limited in some cases. But I give her great compliments for doing what she did. And again, oftentimes parents think, well, we don't need to worry about the kids. They're just kids. They go to church, but they don't really care what's going on at church. No, they should know what's going on at church, and they should hear what's going on at church. And even if they don't understand half of what's said or 90% of what's said in the sermon, it's going into their minds and their brains and their hearts in terms of an attitude and a context that we're here to worship God, that we're here to serve God, that we believe God, that God is the Creator God and He loves us and wants the best for us. That's what they should be learning. And they should be learning that it's a good way of life, not that it's a hard way of life. They will learn that soon enough, that there are tough times when they have to recognize they cannot do it by themselves. But this is not all about specific rules and do's and don'ts, but about an attitude, a lifestyle, example, loving, caring attention, discipline given out of outgoing concern and love to help people achieve what God intends that they achieve, and bringing the child into the process. I think that's another area in which we probably have fallen short over the generations, is bringing the child into the process. Because child rearing, or maybe I should say growing up, requires a team effort. I rarely agreed with a certain lady in high places in our politics, but her concept that it takes a village wasn't all that wrong. That it takes a family, it takes extended family, it takes community, it takes church, it takes circumstances in which there is a context in which people can learn. It's not just about parents being in charge and enforcing the rules. It's about bringing children to maturity with an appreciation for God and all that God will do for them. And so the children need to be involved. They need to be participants. We shouldn't have parents who are fighting against their children because the children are enemies of God's way. We should have parents and children who are learning together how to serve God and how they each have a responsibility to conduct themselves in a way that is pleasing in God's sight. Let's go to Paul's words in Ephesians 6. Ephesians 6, verse 1. Ephesians 6, verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. So the children have a responsibility too. The children have a responsibility to obey God. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, parents who are trying to obey God, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. And what is the promise? That it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. That's what God told Israel. And so he says, you children should obey your parents and honor your father and your mother. That's what life is about. That's what's going to make your life worthwhile. But then he turns immediately to verse 4 and says, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. It's not about pounding something into them. It's not about badgering them. It's not about keeping them so frustrated all the time that God's way becomes anathema to them. God's way becomes a trial and a challenge. You fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. bring them up, work with them, care for them, train them, teach them, instruct them, and when necessary, bring in the blessing and cursing concept with rewards and punishment as needed in a controlled and proper environment so that they can learn what's right. Don't provoke them to wrath because you're bigger than they are. You know, it's not about the father having his way all of the time. So notice that the two together represent, in a sense, a cooperative effort. Children, obey your parents, but fathers, give them a break. Let them learn to obey you. Give them room to obey you. Teach them to obey you. Don't smash them every time they disobey you. If God did that to us, where would we be? If we're going to be like God, we teach and instruct and discipline, but we don't smash. We forgive and we teach and we give a chance to start over again. Bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. That's an ongoing, positive, cooperative effort. Not an I'm in charge, you will do what I say. Now there is an occasional time for because I said so. There's an occasional time when you expect a child to do something because you say so, but that's not good enough reason all of the time. Nor do they understand that unless you've established that you are a loving, kind, instructive parent who has their best interest at heart and who, when you say so, you do it for their good, not for your selfish motivation, not to get them out of your hair. There is a time when children are young, especially, to say, when the child says, "Why should I?" "Because I said so. Because I'm in charge. Because I'm your dad. Because I'm your mother." But that's not the common response. The common question shouldn't even be, "Why should I?" except to say, "Can you explain that to me, Dad or Mom?" Because sometimes children see things we don't see, and they have to come and say, "I don't understand why you're telling me to do this." But if we think, "You have no right to challenge my authority, you'll do it anyway because I said so," well, that's all we're going to get out of it. That isn't the way God works with us. It isn't the way we're supposed to work with our children. Notice in succeeding verses, the next section says in verse 5, "Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters," and tells them to do it with an attitude of service to Christ. But then he turns right around in verse 9 and says, "And you masters..." See, it's the same as the children and the fathers. Children, obey your parents, but fathers, do your part. Servants, obey your masters. Now look, the masters of bond servants had total freedom to do whatever they wanted to do, pretty much. But he says, "You masters, do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven and there is no partiality with him." God is not treating you that way. Don't treat them that way. So the same principle applies to children and parents as it does to bond servants and masters. Both have to do their part for it to work. Otherwise, the slaves are going to run away, or they're going to kill the master. Something's going to happen that is not good. So Paul is giving the principle that there has to be a cooperation here where each has a specific role, and together they make it work. That's the way God works with us. God is the perfect parent. But we have to learn how to cooperate with what he's trying to do in us. If we're continually resisting, we are not the clay that the potter is working with, are we? If we're the axe saying, "Hey, don't swing me that way," we're not exactly being subservient to God and teachable, are we? God is the perfect parent, and he wants to bring us to glory, even as we want to bring our children to maturity and stability and spiritual understanding. God wants to bring us all the way to spiritual glory. But he treats us with tremendous patience, tremendous forgiveness, and he listens to our prayers. And he wants to know what we think about certain issues in our lives. Interesting comment in the book of Isaiah where God is talking to Israel. Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1, God is telling Israel what they need to do, and he's chiding them for what they're not doing and all of that. I won't go into all that here, but down in verse 18, he says to them, "Come now and let us reason together," says the Eternal. Would you ever do that with your children? Should you ever do that with your children? If God did it with his children, maybe we ought to consider what it means to say, come, let us reason together. Let's sit down and talk about this. Explain to me what you have in mind. Explain to me why you feel the way that you do about this rule in our house. Explain to me why you think you should be given an unlimited allowance. Explain to me why you think you shouldn't have to be home at 10 o'clock at night. Explain to me why you think you should be able to drive the car when you're 13. Sit down, let's talk about this. Let's reason together. Let's understand the value of the rules. You see? God is showing respect for what Israel might be thinking. Come, let us reason together. And God says, I have a solution. Verse 18. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. God says, I have the power to forgive. Okay, so you made a mistake. Let's sit down and talk about it. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be as wool. Virtually nothing a child can do in disobedience to the parents, other than some horrid crime that's going to take him away from the parents, is something that cannot be forgiven. Children don't do things generally that cannot be forgiven. Parents have to be forgiving parents, however, and understanding and willing to understand where the child is coming from and what the child's attitude is. Verse 19, if you are willing and obedient, here's the reasoning. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Eternal has spoken. That's the simple principle of teaching our children. There are good ways to live that produce good results, and there are bad ways to live that produce horrible results. Which do you want? They're often too young and too innocent to make the right choices. That's where we have to guide them into the right choices and sometimes prevent them from making the wrong choices until they can look at it maturely enough to be able to make a good choice. God is saying, come, let us reason together. Showing respect for the knowledge and opinions of our children, especially of our teenagers, who are affected by our present evil world and all the other opinions and options they see out there. Why should they think that you're right? Why should they think this church is right? Why should they think we're special? There ought to be some proof in the way you live and some benefit for them. Talking to them is a powerful component. Showing respect for them is a powerful part of that communication. I didn't intend this as a continued sermon, but it looks like it's going to go there. Let's go to at least Proverbs chapter 1. It's always a little difficult, I know, for the ministry to come back from the feast and get excited about preaching some more. Though I didn't have any problem today, but it is a challenge for the brethren as well sometimes to come back from the feast and get excited about sitting through a sermon. So I won't drag you through all of this because there's a ton of material and I tried to prepare what would fit, but I don't think it's going to. Proverbs chapter 1. Let's look at this principle. Here, of course, is a father talking to his son with a particular goal in mind. That goal is mentioned in verse 2. To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion. All of those things are goals of the father talking to his son. And it goes on, coming down to verse 8. My son, hear the instruction of your father. And do not forsake the law of your mother. They're good for you. He puts it in different terms. Verse 9, for they will be a graceful ornament on your head. Young people, especially girls, like ornaments on their heads. Boys might prefer a baseball cap or a crown, but they still want something pretty, something attention-getting, something attractive. There'll be a graceful ornament on your head and chains, meaning necklaces, about your neck. Decorative chains, not restraining chains. They will be ornaments on your head and chains around your neck. I very well remember teaching our children that in the very early years of their lives. I remember our very first child being about 2 years old when we started to teach her that. when she wanted to wear a necklace or, you know, saw something she liked that was pretty, and we would explain to her. Sounds kind of trivial, maybe. Sounds kind of trite to you. Maybe you even think it's hokey. I hope not. But we would say to her, you know, this is pretty, and we know why you like it, and you can wear it. And I'm paraphrasing, of course, all of this. But obeying God and obeying your parents is even prettier. And it becomes a necklace around your neck. And I remember her remembering that and commenting on it for 2 or 3 years thereafter, that obeying her parents and serving God was the same as wearing a beautiful necklace. Children can comprehend that. Children can understand the analogy. And so we're not talking about a bribe here. We're not talking about giving children everything they want, which sometimes parents foolishly do, or trying to say, I will trade you this for that. No, it's an analogy that says this is a spiritual reality, that obeying God is like wearing a beautiful necklace. It's going to give you tremendous benefits and beauty. It's talking about a careful explanation of the benefits of God's way and the dangers of turning away from God's way. It's talking about setting an example in our own lives of expecting God's blessings. Always expecting God's blessings. If we don't expect God's blessings, we certainly can't teach our children to expect God's blessings. We can't even teach them to expect blessings from us. If we misuse them as bribes, or if we don't give them at all, if we don't expect them from God, then we're going to be hard-pressed to teach our children to expect blessings from either parents or from God. Looking at my notes, this appears to be I could actually rush and be done in a couple of minutes. Let's do that. Proverbs chapter 6, while we're here. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 20. Here it is again, verse 20. My son, keep your father's command, and do not forsake the law of your mother. Bind them continually upon your heart. Remember what God told Israel? Put on the doorpost of your house, put them on your fences, whatever. Remember them. Here it is, on your heart. It's the embracing of the truth and the acceptance of a way of life. Bind them continually upon your heart. Tie them around your neck. When you roam, they will lead you. When you sleep, they will keep you. And when you awake, they will speak with you. For the commandment is a lamp and the law a light. Another analogy kids can understand. An opportunity to walk in a way that produces good results. The commandment is a lamp and the law is a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life. They're the way of life. He goes on here to talk to the young man about being allured by a woman. But this is a way of life, is God's law and God's way. And it's to be bound in our hearts. And children can learn to do that, that it's a way of life. And again, child rearing, child training, or what life is all about. If we go back and read what we did in Deuteronomy and other places, Abraham's life, child rearing is what it's all about. It's what perpetuates your life. It's what perpetuates your family. It's what perpetuates your relationship with God. It's what perpetuates the blessings that God pours out. It's what leads a family to ultimately be part of God's family. And so child rearing is, in many ways, well, if you have children, of course, and if you didn't, your parents did, it's what life is all about. And it will always affect the quality of both parents and children. Child rearing affects the quality of life of both. Remember, children are their oppressors and women rule over them. It will affect the quality of life of generations to come as that trickle-down effect occurs. How did society get where it is today? How did innocent little babies grow up to become mass murderers? How did the world produce the Hitlers and Stalins of the world, who killed millions in their quest for personal satisfaction? Called leaders of men. Were they leaders of men? What about those who eagerly followed them? Why will man bring his world to complete destruction? Because they are destroyed for lack of knowledge, and that knowledge starts with the parents and trickles all the way down through succeeding generations. It all goes back to failure to accept God's instruction and to teach it to succeeding generations. God has called us, brethren, to break that cycle, to teach our children, to model God's way of life, to engage our children in understanding who they are and why they're here, to help them understand that it's not just about rules and laws and about obeying mom and dad. It's about a way of life that produces every good thing and a way of life that you're living as with God as your parent and whom you are obeying as thoroughly as you know how in order to be a part of God's family. Your children can pick up on that analogy. They know that God is your father. They hear you pray at meals at least, and maybe you pray with them and should from time to time so that they hear you're praying to your father. They know that you want to obey God, and they will respond to that. So as we have blessed and prayed for the little children throughout God's church today, and that'll probably be still taking place in afternoon services in the far west about right now, it's a good time to think about the family values that God instills, that God ordained, and that we should recognize and have a part in training up children, not only ours, but even those of our brethren, because again, they will see our lifestyles, they will see our commitment, they will see our faith, they will see our enthusiasm, and ultimately they will have to decide whether it deserves to be followed, whether it deserves to be emulated and copied. Child rearing, or as I said, I prefer to call it helping them grow up, is a great responsibility for parents, for grandparents, for all generations. But building up families and our relationships across generations is something for the entire church to do. It's something we must do, something we must build in the way that we treat one another, the example we set for one another, the way we comfort and encourage one another, and yes, from time to time, the way we correct or discipline one another. And when we pray for one another, which we do, and I know that we do, we should also be praying for children, ours and others, praying for children, because those children, as we've seen in Christ's own example of picking them up and laying his hands on them and blessing them, those children are precious in God's sight.